Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day with a broadcast on the radio and a podcast on the internet that tells you about interesting events from around the world. We always present these stories slowly and with words that are easy to understand. That makes it easier for you if American English is not your first language. Today, we have information about a serious subject that many people in this country disagree about. It's time to listen and learn with the Voice of America. An average of one school shooting happens every week in America, says a recent report from Everytown for Gun Safety. The advocacy group seeks to reduce gun violence. The report lists 150 school shootings that have happened since the end of 2012. Jonathan Evans and Ashley Thompson take a look at gun violence in the United States.
School officials across the country do all they can to protect students. But for one elementary school in Northern Virginia, the opening of a nearby gun store has led to fear, protests, and anger. Franklin Sherman Elementary is in the small community of McLean, Virginia. The school keeps all doors locked during the day. It has security cameras at the front entrance. Teachers and students practice monthly lockdown drills to prepare for what to do if an active shooter enters the building. In early October, Nova Firearms opened in McLean, less than 20 meters from Franklin Sherman. Jane Strauss is a longtime school board member at Fairfax County Public Schools, which oversees Franklin Sherman.
The gun store itself sits, its property directly abuts the Franklin Sherman Elementary School, and it isn't as though there's some big playing field or football field between the gun store and the school. The back property line is about 50 feet from the cafeteria and the classroom windows. You can see the elementary school clearly from the gun store.
Hundreds of parents protested on the store's opening day. They argued that it is too close to the school. Some said they did not feel safe enough to send their children to Franklin Sherman. The manager of Nova Firearms, Rachel Dresser, says her store has done nothing wrong. The state of Virginia permits firearms to be sold in any area that is commercially zoned.
The community response, which was extremely unexpected. I did expect some people to maybe not be as excited,
right.
But I did not expect this level of resistance and animosity.
What happened in McLean represents one of the most divisive issues in America, gun rights. The Second Amendment of the United States Constitution says, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." Each state has its own gun laws. For example, some states offer licenses that permit a person to carry a gun, either openly or as a concealed weapon. Eight states and the District of Columbia require background checks before a person can buy a gun.
After the shooting at Sandy Hook, a Gallup poll found that 58% of Americans questioned feel that laws on gun sales should be stricter. In the most recent Gallup poll, taken after the shooting in Oregon, 55% of Americans felt the same way, and 43% said they own a gun. The Gallup poll also found that 58% of Americans have a favorable opinion of the National Rifle Association, or NRA. The NRA is a nationwide organization that advocates for the rights to own guns.
On the day of the Sandy Hook shootings, an emotional President Barack Obama addressed the nation. In his speech, Mr. Obama demanded meaningful action.
As a country, we have been through this too many times. Whether it's an elementary school in Newton or a shopping mall in Oregon or a temple in Wisconsin or a movie theater in Aurora or a street corner in Chicago, these neighborhoods are our neighborhoods, and these children are our children. And we're going to have to come together and take meaningful action to prevent more tragedies like this, regardless of the politics.
A month after the shooting at Sandy Hook, Obama announced several new measures to help keep students safe. Among other policies, he urged Congress to restore a ban on military-style firearms. But the NRA directed resources, including money, to fight the firearms ban, and won. The group regularly works to defeat politicians who speak out in favor of stricter gun laws.
The issue of gun laws took center stage earlier this month in the first debate between Democratic presidential candidates. Candidate Hillary Clinton criticized opponent Bernie Sanders for his position on gun control. In her words, he is not at all strict enough. I think that we have to look at the fact that we lose 90 people a day from gun violence. This has gone on too long, and it's time the entire country stood up against the NRA. The majority of our country supports background checks, and even the majority of gun owners do, Clinton said. Shortly after the school shooting in Oregon, President Obama said he was considering an executive order on gun access. The president's order would require dealers who sell a high number of guns to have a license from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. It would also require dealers to perform background checks on their buyers. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has called the president's executive order a move to take your guns away.
Back in McLean, Virginia, Rachel Dresser of Nova Firearms says business is better than ever. After the protests and media attention, she says more people know about the business.
They wanted to be on the news and get their point across, but at the same rate, they put us on the news and got our name out there. It brought awareness to us on both sides.
Dresser also says sales go up after school shootings and other gun tragedies, especially after politicians speak about the need for stronger gun laws.
Mostly we see an increase in sales because there's an increase in rhetoric regarding gun restrictions, and so people want to make sure that they exercise their right to purchase while it's still there.
I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Jonathan Evans.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Many cultures around the world have a grain that is not grown or even known outside its home area. Quinoa is from South America. Amaranth fed the Aztecs in Central America. Now, an ancient grain from Ethiopia, teff, is appearing on grocery shelves in America. Teff has been an important part of the Ethiopian diet for thousands of years. It is used mainly to make flour. Teff has a mild, nutty, or earthy taste. Teff flour is the key ingredient for the well-known spongy flatbread found in Ethiopian restaurants. Wayne Carlson learned about teff while doing public health work in Africa in the mid-1970s.
I came to know teff because I was eating it all the time and hosted by teff farmers.
In the late 70s, Carlson returned to the U.S., married, and settled in southwest Idaho. Then he came up with an idea to introduce teff grass to North America in his home state.
Geologically, it's very similar to Ethiopia. Ethiopia is placed on the East African Rift Valley, which is very much like the Snake River Plain.
Wayne and his wife Elizabeth are not farmers, nor do they want to be. So they convinced actual farmers in Idaho, Oregon, and Nevada to grow teff on contract for them. The Carlsons milled it themselves. The Carlsons say the teff flour coming off the mill could end up in an upscale natural foods store or commercial bakery. Sales of alternatives to modern wheat are growing quickly each year, says an industry trade group. Rich Roseberg is a food researcher at Oregon State University. He says teff production has exploded over the past decade in the U.S. The grain has gone from 1,200 hectares in 2003 to more than 40,000 nationally by 2010. Teff contains lots of calcium, iron, protein, and fiber. The new grain is really an ancient one, but Wayne Carlson does not like the term ancient grains to describe teff.
Teff was never really a relic. It was never bypassed by history. Teff has always been the mainstay crop for millions and millions of people. And it's just that they were geographically isolated in Northeast Africa. Mm-hmm. So all we've done is said to the rest of the world, hey, look, there's this really good stuff there. Why don't you incorporate it into your diet?
And the rest of the world is doing just that. I'm Marcia James.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Just before sunrise on April 12, 1861, the first shot was fired in the American Civil War. A heavy mortar roared, sending a shell high over the harbor at Charleston, South Carolina.
The shell dropped and exploded above Fort Sumter, a United States military base on an island in the harbor. The explosion was a signal for all Confederate guns surrounding the fort to open fire. Shell after shell smashed into the fort. The booming of the cannons woke the people of Charleston. They rushed to the harbor and cheered as the bursting shells lighted the dark sky. This week in our series, Jack Moyles and Stuart Spencer tell about the attack on Fort Sumter.
Confederate leaders ordered the attack after President Abraham Lincoln refused to withdraw the small force of American soldiers at Sumter. Food supplies at the fort were very low, and Southerners expected hunger would force the soldiers to leave. But Lincoln announced he was sending a ship to Fort Sumter with food. Confederate President Jefferson Davis ordered his commander in Charleston, General Beauregard, to destroy the fort before the food could arrive.
The attack started from Fort Johnson, across the harbor from Sumter. A Virginia congressman, Roger Pryor, was visiting Fort Johnson when the order to fire was given. The fort's commander asked Pryor if he would like the honor of firing the mortar that would begin the attack. "No," answered Pryor, and his voice shook. "I cannot fire the first gun of the war." But others could, and the attack began.
At Fort Sumter, Major Robert Anderson and his men waited 3 hours before firing back at the Confederate guns. Anderson could not use his most powerful cannons. They were in the open, at the top of the fort, where there was no protection for the gunners. Too many of his small force would be lost if he tried to fire these guns. So Anderson had his men fire the smaller cannon from better protected positions. These, however, did not do much damage to the Confederate guns.
The shelling continued all day. A big cloud of smoke rose high in the air over Fort Sumter. The smoke was seen by United States Navy ships a few miles outside Charleston Harbor. They had come with the ship bringing food for the men at Sumter. There were soldiers on these ships, but they could not reach the fort to help Major Anderson. Confederate boats blocked the entrance to the harbor, and Confederate guns could destroy any ship that tried to enter. The commander of the naval force, Captain Fox, had hoped to move the soldiers to Sumter in small boats, but the sea was so rough that the small boats could not be used. Fox could only watch and hope for calmer seas.
Confederate shells continued to smash into Sumter throughout the night and into the morning of the second day. The fires at Fort Sumter burned higher, and smoke filled the rooms where soldiers still tried to fire their cannons. About noon, three men arrived at the fort in a small boat. One of them was Lewis Wigfall, a former United States senator from Texas, now a Confederate officer. He asked to see Major Anderson. "I come from General Beauregard," he said. "It is time to put a stop to this, sir. The flames are raging all around you, and you have defended your flag bravely." "Will you leave, sir?" Wigfall asked.
Major Anderson was ready to stop fighting. His men had done all that could be expected of them. They had fought well against a much stronger enemy. Anderson said he would surrender if he and his men could leave with honor. Wigfall agreed. He told Anderson to lower his flag, and the firing would stop. Down came the United States flag, and up went the white flag of surrender. The battle of Fort Sumter was over. More than 4,000 shells had been fired during the 33 hours of fighting, but no one on either side was killed. One United States soldier, however, was killed the next day when a cannon exploded as Anderson's men prepared to leave the fort.
The news of Anderson's surrender reached Washington late Saturday, April 13th. President Lincoln and his cabinet met the next day and wrote a declaration that the president would announce on Monday. In it, Lincoln said powerful forces had seized control in 7 states of the South. He said these forces were too strong to be stopped by courts or policemen. Lincoln said troops were needed. He requested that the states send him 75,000 soldiers. He said these men would be used to get control of forts and other federal property seized from the Union.
Lincoln knew he had the support of his own party. He also wanted Northern Democrats to give him full support. So, Sunday evening, a Republican congressman visited the top Democrat of the North, Senator Stephen Douglas. The congressman urged Douglas to go to the White House and tell Lincoln that he would do all he could to help put down the rebellion in the South. At first, Douglas refused. He said Lincoln had removed Democrats, friends of his, from government jobs, and had given the jobs to Republicans. Douglas said he didn't like this. Anyway, he said, Lincoln probably did not want his advice. The congressman, George Ashman, urged Douglas to forget party politics. He said Lincoln and the country needed the senator's help. Douglas finally agreed to talk with Lincoln. He and Ashman went immediately to the White House.
Lincoln welcomed his old political opponent. He explained his plans and read to Douglas the declaration he would announce the next day. Douglas said he agreed with every word of it, except, he said, 75,000 soldiers would not be enough. Remembering his problems with Southern extremists, he urged Lincoln to ask for 200,000 men. He told the president, "You do not know the dishonest purposes of those men as well as I do." Lincoln and Douglas talked for 2 hours. Then the senator gave a statement for the newspapers. He said he still opposed the administration on political questions, but, he said, he completely supported Lincoln's efforts to protect the Union. Douglas was to live for only a few more months. He spent this time working for the Union. He traveled through the states of the Northwest, making many speeches. Douglas urged Democrats everywhere to support the Republican government. He told them, "There can be no neutrals in this war, only patriots or traitors."
Throughout the North, thousands of men rushed to answer Lincoln's call for troops. Within 2 days, a military group from Boston left for Washington. Other groups formed quickly in northern cities and began training for war. Lincoln received a different answer, however, from the border states between North and South. Virginia's governor said he would not send troops to help the North get control of the South. North Carolina's governor said the request violated the Constitution. He would have no part of it. Tennessee said it would not send one man to help force southern states back into the Union. But it said it would send 50,000 troops to defend southern rights. Lincoln got the same answer from the governors of Kentucky, Arkansas, and Missouri. For several days, it seemed that all these states would secede and join the Southern Confederacy.
Lincoln worried most about Virginia, the powerful state just across the Potomac River from Washington. A secession convention already was meeting at the state capital. On April 17th, the convention voted to take Virginia out of the Union. Virginia's vote to secede forced an American Army officer to make a most difficult decision. The officer was Colonel Robert E. Lee, a citizen of Virginia. The Army's top commander, General Winfield Scott, had called Lee to Washington. Scott believed Lee was the best officer in the Army. Lincoln agreed. He asked Lee to take General Scott's job to become the Army chief. Lee was offered the job on the same day that Virginia left the Union.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Jack Moyles and Stuart Spencer. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts are online, along with historical pictures, at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow our programs at twitter.com/voalearnenglish. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.